Full Service Radio is proudly supported and hosted by Simplecast, the easiest way for a podcast creator to publish and distribute audio on the internet. For more information, visit simplecast.com.
Tune in to Full Service Radio.
Full Service Radio.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service.
Full Service Radio.
Hey, everybody. It's Nikki Nellis. Industry Night with Foodie and the Beast. I'm here at the Line Hotel. And once again, I am beastless. It's just me, Nikki Nellis, the foodie, here at the gorgeous Line Hotel. It's so gorgeous out today. It's actually light in the studio. I feel like daylight savings. It's almost like over and like we're getting back to reality and spring is coming. But I'm really excited about today's show because we're going to be talking to some really interesting people. First and foremost, we'll be talking to Kiko Bourne, who I met a long time ago when she was with the Capital Area Food Bank. And now she actually has a show here at the Line Hotel, and it's called Lunch Agenda. It is on Mondays at noon.
No, it's actually now on Tuesdays at 4.
Oh, you changed it.
Because
you didn't
I'm a teacher,
me.
And Mondays at noon just didn't work with that teaching schedule.
Well, let's
schedule.
Talk a little bit about the Lunch Agenda and what you're doing there.
Yeah, absolutely. So thank you for having me, Nikki.
Of course, I'm so delighted.
It's funny to be sitting in the guest seat.
Right,
today.
For a change. But, you know, I do want to just give a shout out. So for those of you who are tuning in for the whole show, I want to let you know that later in the show, I have Chef Justin Servino. He is a four-time James Beard Foundation Award nominee. He is a Best Chef Mid-Atlantic. I'm sorry. And a 2015 and 2014 winner of Food and Wine's The People's Best New Chef Mid-Atlantic. He's got some interesting things cooking up. I have had the luxury of dining at his restaurant Cure, which by the way is closing later in March in Pittsburgh, but there's a reason for that, and we're going to get into all of the things he's curing a little bit in the show. So sorry, want to go back to you, Kiko. So talk about Lunch Agenda and the kinds of things you're talking about there.
Absolutely. I have had the pleasure and privilege of working in kind of a lot of different parts of the food system that are not necessarily restaurants, which is what I think most people think of when they think of food media. Mm-hmm. I've worked in a grocery group in San Francisco called Byright, and I've worked in as a server in restaurants, and I've worked at the Capital Area Food Bank, and I've worked with Salu Bakery here in D.C., and
right.
I now am a cooking and gardening teacher. So my goal with Lunch Agenda is to shine the light on parts of the food system that people haven't learned as much about yet.
Right.
And so I cover topics like food policy, and I cover topics like environmental stewardship, and, you know, I cover things like what are some roles in the food system that you haven't heard of? The HR person, the accounting person. So I'm trying to really school my listeners on, you know, undercovered parts of food.
Well, I think that's a really excellent point because working in the food industry, the restaurant industry, is not limited to just being in the kitchen, right? There's so many moving parts and there's so many ways to be a part of the industry that people don't even know about them. And I think highlighting them, spotlighting those different ways that you can work within the industry, whether you're a purveyor of food, an artisan, some sort of conduit in some way. There's so many different ways for people to be a part of this industry
yeah.
without actually being in the kitchen. Not that there's anything wrong with being in the kitchen, but not everybody can do that.
And if only I knew all the options back when I was trying to enter the industry originally. So,
right. Is that what you wanted to do originally?
I knew I wanted to talk about food and work in food my whole childhood, but
I mean, that is exactly me
yeah.
as well. I mean, I started cooking as soon as I possibly could. I loved entertaining. My girlfriend and I, when we were 13, were throwing elaborate dinner parties for
Ooh.
Our parents' friends and our friends who were like, what are you people doing? We, you know, where Gourmet Magazine was our Bible. I knew I wanted to be in the food world, but I didn't know how. I didn't know how to get in there.
And you probably didn't have many role models doing what you've carved out for yourself to do today.
No,
either.
I appreciate that. But
yeah.
no, I mean, when I first when I was in school, my dream job would have been to be a food critic, right? Because I thought that's the way in.
Me too.
But of course, now I look at that and I think I wouldn't want to be a food critic for all the money in the world. That's the, of all the food writing gigs, to me, that one doesn't get to amplify, support, and promote what's going on in the restaurant industry. You have to judge it. And that does not ring true to me. That is not how I want to, that's not my wheelhouse. I want to amplify. I want to be a megaphone for the good. I don't want to have to like critique or nitpick on things. You know what I mean?
I've always dreamed of being Barbara Walters of food.
Excellent. So you and me both. Right there with you, baby. We'll be next to each other. Yep. Okay. So tell me, you have a really interesting
series coming.
Yeah. So let's talk about that series.
Absolutely. So I'm really excited to be partnering with the Bainum Foundation. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Bainum has been investing in resources for children in this area for over 50 years.
Can we back up? Because I don't think people know who the Bainum is. Who is that? And what do they do?
So
the foundation.
The foundation has all different kinds of giving areas that bolster the opportunities for children living in poverty.
Okay.
But it's only been in recent years that they've moved, you know, they've zoomed in on food as an area of opportunity and become a really dynamic funder of food-based initiatives. And that's why I approached them, is because I've always wanted to do a series about investment in food. Mm-hmm. Because we hear about, you know, venture capital investment in fast casual concepts like Sweet Green.
Or Kava.
Right? Or, you know, we've begun to hear a lot about big investments in clean meat or, you know, in all these tech platforms like Instacart. But there's so much more money being you know, moved around and put behind food concepts. And, you know, it's coming from foundations like Bainum. It's coming from individuals. It's coming from corporations. Mm-hmm. And a lot of huge corporations are starting their own giving arms.
But are they all giving it? Because when I think of, like, what's going on in Silicon Valley and the way that they are throwing money, really, at some, not just fast casual concepts, but at concepts in general, some of them, they don't even have a platform that'll necessarily work. I mean, I've consulted with some companies, as I'm sure you have too, where, you know, it's all about getting your series, get your series A, get your series B, get your, like, once you start getting your series, then whatever you're working on doesn't seem to be as much of a priority because now that you've gotten your series funding, you've proven you can make money.
Interesting.
So I'm just, you know, I'm so fascinated by how the Silicon Valley model actually can affect what we're doing in the food world. Well, not me, but what you're doing with this organization in the food world.
Right. And I really see investors or investment as kind of like a crystal ball towards where our food system is going. And, you know, where they're channeling their sight is, you know, what we can expect to see grow and, you know, have big impact in 5, 10, 50 years. Mm-hmm. So luckily, I have Eric Kessler from Arabella Advisors coming in to kind of give us a landscape overview in the first episode of the series. Mm-hmm. I'll have two of Bainum's leaders, Katie Jones and Leela Otis, as guests in a couple of the episodes to talk about how a foundation assesses its impact and makes its decisions. And I'm really hoping that the series will be useful not only for organizations that are looking for investment to kind of, as I said, get into the investor's brain, but also for organizations that are considering taking investment, because who you take investment from equates to who has power in your decision making. And I've got an amazing leader named Dennis Derrick with Corbin Hill, which is out of New York, who is going to talk about how he has turned away funds based on, you know, who he wants to have a voice and how he's trying to drive food sovereignty through his work. So,
I mean, that's fascinating because it's very hard to say no to money, especially when you're looking to get something off the ground. You know, I mean, a lot of these smaller organizations who are looking to get food into the right hands, which I know you've done a lot of work with, you know, being with the Capital Area Food Bank, you know, it's hard to say no to that money when somebody's writing a big check, but they're like, but I want, that check comes with strings. It's really hard to not take it.
Yeah, absolutely. So the series is every Tuesday in March.
Okay.
It's, you know, again, my show is called Lunch Agenda, and I'll have two or three guests.
But now it's a late lunch
one.
Agenda.
It's a late lunch. It's a lanner.
It's okay. It's yeah. late lunch.
The beauty of podcasts. You can still eat it while you eat your lunch away from your desk. You can right. still use my show to take a screen break and you know, learn about a piece of this food system that you want to, you know, become more educated about.
Well, I'm very excited about the series.
Thanks, Nikki.
You do such great work, and I'm so thrilled you could pop in today. So
thank
tell
you.
Everybody again where they can find you, how they know what you're doing, and when the series airs.
Absolutely. So I'm Kiko Bourne. You can find me on Instagram at Kiko Buff, and I have a website called kikosfoodnews.com because I actually start every episode with a few headlines about broader food systems news of that week.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find Lunch Agenda on all your favorite podcast apps, just like Industry Night.
Right.
And you can look for this series starting March 12th.
Excellent. Well, I can't wait to tune in. Thank you so much
Thank
for joining
you,
me.
Nikki.
And congratulations on the good news.
Thank you.
Okay. See you soon.
Bye.
Okay, up next, we are going to be talking to Justin Servino. He is a four-time James Beard Foundation Award nominee for Best Chef Mid-Atlantic. And I have had the luxury of dining in his restaurant, Cure, in Pittsburgh years ago, kind of when it first opened. And Justin was really at the forefront of the charcuterie trend. Believe it or not, 10 years ago, you didn't see charcuterie on every menu that you walked into, not just in the DC market, but nationally. And now charcuterie is sort of the norm. It's available. There's lots of incredible salamis and meats available. And Justin was at the forefront of it. So, Justin, are you there?
I sure am.
Hey, how are you?
I'm great. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Oh, absolutely. So, I want to get a little background on you, Justin. How did you get into cooking? How did you get into the food world? How did it all start for you?
Very much cooking for me was a part of my childhood.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in an Italian-American family, and it didn't really matter what was happening in my family's life. At the end of every day, we sat down and ate together, and I really didn't understand, you know, in the moment, how important that was to me until I moved out of my parents' house and I decided that I wasn't going to go to college because I didn't know what I wanted to do. And so I went to work for my dad. He owned a construction company.
Mm-hmm.
And
I just want to say how nice that was of you to do for your parents by not going to college and giving
yeah,
them a huge
I mean,
bill.
We grew up without not a ton of money, and I just saw it as, you know, my parents encouraged me to go to college, but I just knew that I was wasting their money. So that was really the best thing I ever did. So yeah, I worked for my dad, and the job was working construction and kind of basically being on the road all week. So we were living in hotels and eating out, and basically for the first time in my life, I realized how important eating my mom and my grandmother's food was. And so I approached my dad, and I was like, hey, you know, what if instead of renting nights in, we get an apartment that's furnished, and I can leave work a little bit early and help put some food together? And realistically, that turned into basically me spending most of my free time either cooking with my mom or my grandmother or teaching myself how to cook. And then I decided I didn't want to work construction for the rest of my life. And
mm-hmm.
I had a quick conversation with my dad about it. My dad said, well, that's great. Go to college. What do you want to do? And pretty much I just hated working construction so much that I just thought to myself, well, what do I like to do? I like to cook. So I visited the culinary school here in Pittsburgh,
mm-hmm.
and I took an entrance exam that day and was accepted and signed up for classes. And I would say without a doubt the best bad decision I've ever made in my life because I really didn't know what I was getting myself into.
Right.
I was just trying to escape working construction, and my life has been pretty much dedicated to the craft of cooking ever since. It's been fantastic.
Well, once you started at school, even though you feel like you went because it was a last-ditch effort, did you have a aha moment while at school? When was your aha moment? I mean, clearly you got the apartment, you were cooking. It was a part of your life that you enjoyed. But at what point were you, was it in school or where were you like, oh, this is it?
You know, I think honestly,
passion.
I was such a such a terrible student in college that actually, like, day one of culinary school, knowing that it was something that I wanted to love and that was an opportunity, I remember just, like, feeling this sense of calm because I finally found something that, you know, I was interested in and I was willing to dedicate myself to.
That's, I love that. I went, years ago, after I started in the industry, I'm on the writing side, but I went to, I was invited up to Hyde Park to check out the culinary school there and the CIA. And I remember walking around the halls and they let me sit in on some of the classes because I was doing a story about the CIA. And I was like, oh, this is where I was supposed to go to school. You know, I mean, I went to school in Boston, but when I got there, I was like, these are my people. I get what's happening here. So I can totally appreciate winding up there and being like, yeah, this works for me. After you left school, you get out into the real world. How do you apply everything you just learned?
Well, part of the reason I wanted to go to culinary school was because I saw it as an opportunity to travel. I grew up in a really small town in Ohio, and, you know, moved to Pittsburgh, and I really just wanted to get out of the area. So my girlfriend at the time, who's now my baby's mama, her name's Hillary. She's also my business partner.
Right.
She went to the same school I went to for hotel restaurant management for the same reasons. And so we moved to Kentucky for about a year, and then because she got a job there, and then we moved to California. And that was my idea. I really just wanted to move out west. And the goal was to work at a great restaurant until I could gain the skills to work at a better restaurant and so on and so forth.
So were you stodging or were you working?
I was doing both. So I got a job at a restaurant called Marinas at Bernardus Lodge in Carmel Valley through a local chef that I was, a chef named Bill Fuller here in Pittsburgh. I was working at his restaurant called Casbah. And he hooked me up with a guy named Matt Millay, who is a Pittsburgh guy that is still living in Monterey. And that was my ticket in to working in California.
Not a bad place to be working.
No.
Carmel is fabulous. But yet you still had your sort of East Coast strings pulling you back to Pittsburgh. What made you decide to come back?
Yeah, so I spent, I guess, about a better part of 8 years in California. I worked at Marina Set Bernardus Lodge. I worked at the Big Sur Bakery. I worked for I would say, the man that's mentored me most, a guy named Walter Mansky, at a bunch of restaurants in Carmel, Boucher and Cantonetta de Luca and La Auberge Carmel. Mm-hmm. And then I worked at Manresa for David Kinch.
Sure.
And somewhere in that, so I think when I was working for Walter at La Auberge Carmel, I was educating myself on where food came from. And, you know, for me, being a kid from, I'm in my early 20s at this point, and being a kid from Northeast Ohio, you know, living in Monterey, California, and working with food naturally becomes something real, you know, because you can see it. It's growing out of the cracks of the sidewalk, and, you know, you take a walk through the woods, and you're looking at mushrooms, and, you know, there's abalone right on the coast, and there's farmers markets, you know, 5 days a week. And so the reality of what food was became very real to me, and I was spending a lot of my spare time, not at work, really pushing myself to learn more and more and more about what food was. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, I think I read The Omnivore's Dilemma, and I know that I read it.
Right, we all read it. Didn't we all read it?
Yeah. And, you know, I was doing things like watching Joel Salatin speak on the old YouTubes and just learning these things that I never even questioned. Like, I remember one week in my life, and I wasn't working for Walter. I had a job that will remain nameless. It was me taking a break from fine dining food. And I went to work every day and was just basically cutting chickens and portioning steaks. And I went home one day and was watching some things on YouTube and was watching something about how factory farm chickens, they gain weight so fast that they can't hold their own body weight up, and they drag their breasts across the ground. And every single factory farm chicken has this blister on their breast. And I realized that the majority of every chicken I'd ever cut into had that blister.
Oh my God, that must have been really upsetting. That's so upsetting.
Yeah, it was a moment for me. You know, I was like, well, what am I doing? You know, like, if if I'm going to dedicate all of this time and energy into spending my time being a food professional, like how do I make a difference, you know? And basically what I summed it up to was what I needed to do was make a difference in my personal life. And I needed to figure out how to make those choices for myself at home before I could find out how to work at a place that was making those choices. So,
well, how did you do that? I think people, even today, it shouldn't be a struggle, because especially like those of us who live in Washington, D.C., there's so much available, from farmers markets to produce, and so many people are educated. But I think as a whole, people go blindly by where they just think it's all taken care of for them. Do you know what I mean?
Well, convenience is what stops our motivation, and I'm as guilty as that as anyone else. You know, it's easy to go to Trader Joe's and buy everything you need for the week.
It's true. Yes.
There's a reason why there's not a butcher shop in every neighborhood. You know, it's at this point a neighborhood butcher shop is a failed concept.
It's hard for those. And trust me, they've tried opening in D.C. and there are a few here, and I'm sure you know that they're financially struggling. It's not.
Well, and then
easy.
Your competitor is Giant Eagle, and it doesn't matter where you buy your food from. You know, and clearly you're paying more money for your food, but. It's a really hard thing to get into, but.
So how did you do it? Yeah, how'd you do it for yourself first?
So I stopped eating meat, and it
says
wasn't
the guy who's curing,
right.
who's creating salamis,
thousands of pounds of salami.
Right,
but I stopped eating meat, and I didn't stop eating meat with the intention of never eating meat again. I just felt like. If I was going to actually take it seriously, I needed to stop eating meat and really educate. And that's easy to do when you live in Monterey, California. But I took
so
a really
that
laid
mean,
back.
Does that mean meat, chicken? What did you? Was it just?
I was a ovo-lacto pescatarian.
Okay, that sounds very Californian. Just
cheese,
so you know,
cheese and eggs and fish. So I took a really laid back job at a vegetarian restaurant, Pacific Grove, California, and. I only worked like 3 days a week, and I spent the rest of my time introducing myself to farmers at farmers markets. I became friends with some of them. I became better friends with a couple of them in particular, and then I started spending time on farms, and I was really mostly trying to spend time with farmers that were growing animals. And then at one point I realized that if I was going to eat meat, I needed to take an animal's life. So I volunteered for a slaughter day at a farm in I think Watsonville.
Okay.
And I showed up and helped, you know, slaughter a flock of chickens. And I basically realized that at that point I deserved to eat meat again. So I ate one of those chickens that night.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not, you know, it's not enjoyable, but you know, and I don't know that everybody needs to take an animal's life to respect it. But for me, I feel like my goals for myself there in the moment and for the future were to play a big role in food in a community somewhere someday. And I just felt like the only way I'm going to know, understand, and respect this is to do it. And I continue to do it on a very small basis. Mm-hmm. And it's usually when I feel like I've gotten too comfortable with my own reality of food.
Well, I think it's important to challenge yourself, which you clearly are doing. I mean, we haven't even gotten into where you are right now, all these years later, but challenging yourself in this food world, especially when there is so much available, and you're right, convenience is part of the problem. And I think Trader Joe's is such a great example, because I believe that when we go shopping, we think, well, if it's here, then it must be checked out already. This must be an animal that's treated well, or my eggs say they're pasture raised. You know, I think we're very trusting because it's easier than asking the hard questions.
No, and we're all very busy, you know. I mean, there's the reality of do you have time to go to another store?
Right.
I mean, I think that is the sad reality of it, though.
No, I think you're 100% right. Well, listen, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I want to talk, let's jump forward a little bit. Let's get to the start of Cure and your creation of all these fabulous products. And we'll fast forward to all the good news that's happening for you right now. This is Nikki Nellis. I am at the Line Hotel. It's industry night. And we'll be back in just a sec. Yeah. Hey there, it's Nikki Nellis. We are live at the Line Hotel on Full Service Radio. It is Industry Night, and I am talking today with Justin Servino, who is a fabulous chef out of Pittsburgh, and he created Cure about 7 years ago, right, Justin?
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah,
just 7 years. And has other restaurants, a new one opening up soon, and online salami is available, but we're going to get there in just a second. So, Justin, when you leave California, you wind up back in Pittsburgh. What brings you back home-ish? Because I know you're originally from Ohio, but what brings you back to Pittsburgh?
I owned a butcher shop in Santa Cruz, California, called San Marino's Community Butcher.
Oh.
And, yeah, I owned it for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
I rented a space in a communal kitchen, and I sold only at farmers markets in Santa Cruz, Monterey, and Silicon Valley.
So was it, this and, sort of takes us from where we were before the commercial break. So you started working with farmers, creating friendships, and then you decided to what?
I went back to work in fine dining, and that's when I worked at Manresa.
Mm-hmm.
I worked there for about 2 years, and that's actually where I really honed in, or at least started to hone in the skill of butchering whole pigs.
Okay.
Fast forward, while I was working at Manresa, I met a guy named Jim who owned a farm named Tastes Like Chicken Ranch, and mm-hmm. he was growing chickens for eggs mostly, but he really wanted to grow pigs, and I really wanted to butcher pigs, and our relationship blossomed pretty quickly.
And can we just lay it out there? I mean, it's not like butchering pigs is some easy task. That's like a workout.
Yeah, it's the best CrossFit I've ever done.
Yeah, I bet. It's hard.
If
you
I really
want to
get into shape, if I really want to get into shape, I think like 6 or 7 pigs a week does it.
Okay.
Maybe. But yeah, so long story short, at a certain point, this man Jim, he was growing pigs, and I was butchering them for him, but for his customers, right? So mm-hmm. like you would buy a whole or a half pig, and I would butcher it in the back of a friend's restaurant with, you know, pretty much illegally, and you'd give me cash for the process.
Right.
And I basically turned that into a little farmer's market butcher shop situation. And the business was actually great. And my wife and I ran it, and it grew to the point where we needed to get into our own space, and I just couldn't sign a lease. If previous to that, if someone would ask me if I'd ever live in Pennsylvania or Ohio or anywhere outside of the West Coast ever again, I would have said no.
Right. But that's why that's why it's never say never, because you never know what's going to happen next.
Right. Yeah, and, you know, I just, for some reason, the idea of signing I think it was like a 10-year lease made me think for the first time, like, oh, yeah, I have like some grandparents and brothers and, you know, nephews mm-hmm. and nieces and old friends. And it was a really quick and easy decision for my wife and I to make. We ended up moving back to Pittsburgh, I think, within like 3 months of not signing the lease. And it was because I really wanted to open a restaurant called Cure in somewhere in the Bay Area. And just the reality of the cost of opening it and being so far away from, you know, your real support systems. We moved back to Pittsburgh, and basically every day that I was in Pittsburgh was working towards opening Cure.
So you moved back to Pittsburgh, and at this point, is Pittsburgh has, like, the culinary revolution begun at this point in Pittsburgh? Is this 10 years ago? How long ago are we talking?
Yeah, this was 2007,
okay.
So no. I would say no. I think I opened Cure.
Was at the forefront of it?
I opened Cure the day before 2012. And
okay.
Previous to Cure opening, there was, I guess there was a restaurant, it was Salt of the Earth, Route 174, Spoon, maybe Butcher mm-hmm. and Rye. There's maybe 4 or 5 other like small chef owned restaurants in Pittsburgh.
Okay. So,
yeah.
You're
so yeah, I mean, I was like the first year.
So you're there for a while, and you already know you want to do Cure. Now, is the concept formulated in your head? You know, you want, I mean, Cure relating to charcuterie, you know, this is something that you want to do?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. I'd basically been obsessing about it.
You don't sound like you're obsessive at all. Nothing about you strikes me as obsessive. So when did that start? Because it takes a lot to create a variety of charcuterie options. And there's also a lot of legality that goes hand in hand with making charcuterie.
You'd be surprised. Making charcuterie in a restaurant, it can be a lot easier than most people think.
Okay, do tell.
And I think there's a lot of unknown, which makes most people think that there's a lot more that goes into it. But legally, you have to be sanctioned by your local health department. It's actually the easiest way to make charcuterie is in a restaurant.
Mm-hmm.
You have to have a HACCP plan or maybe two. But at this point in the restaurant world, I think you'd be lucky to find a restaurant that doesn't have at least one HACCP plan. The reality of it is I'm allowed to sell to the end consumer, right? So
right.
I'm not allowed to sell to anyone that's then going to resell it. And when you do that, that's when the USDA gets involved.
Gets involved. Okay. So, yeah. So in creating Cure, what was your vision? What were you looking to do?
Realistically, what I wanted to do was I wanted to do my own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, that is what Cure has always been to me. And that is what Cure is to me today. But, I would say a huge driving factor in me opening Cure was I really wanted to find a place to own or have my own whole hog charcuterie program.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd been able to in the past, make charcuterie in a butcher shop setting, but the thing that I missed while only working in a butcher shop was putting food on plates.
Sure.
And I was also doing the math, when you sell a chunk of cured meat or a piece of salami, your profit margin on it is much different than if you turn a whole pig into charcuterie and slice it thin and put it on a plate and sell it to people. And the whole time I was doing business when owning my butcher shop, I thought to myself that was my reasoning for wanting to open a restaurant, because I thought this is how I make financial sense of buying whole pigs and turning it into charcuterie.
Mm-hmm. And so, but at this point, you're just making it for your own restaurant. You launch Cure. It's a tremendous success. And how did it evolve over the years that it was opened?
Cure. So when I opened Cure, I didn't have enough money to open Cure. So I rented a space in a neighborhood that didn't have any other restaurants like it,
mm-hmm.
because I needed to go to a place where I could afford. And I couldn't afford a contractor, so myself and two of my best friends literally did all the work. So I went into the space and totally gutted it and turned it into what it is today.
That's amazing.
Thank you. And then I've remodeled it, maybe six times. So I would say there's one thing I could say about Cure and what it means to me. I would say that it is actually very much a reflection of who I am.
Mm-hmm.
Cure is exactly how I want people to eat. Cure was exactly how I wanted, and still is, how I want to teach cooks how to cook.
For people who haven't been there, what is that? What can we get a little vision of the menu? Tell us what it is.
I call it extra local urban Mediterranean food, because that kind of makes people ask, what the hell does that mean?
Right, of course.
And that's kind of what I'm going for. But Cure, the menu and the style of food at Cure has continually evolved based on what my wants are. And I think that's what makes it a nice restaurant, is that there is someone that is passionate enough about food to create a place for you to experience it all the time.
Right.
I lean really heavily on French and Italian food. I used to cook a lot more Spanish food at Cure than I do now, because we opened a Spanish restaurant called Morcia.
Right. I was going to get to that. Now, when did that open?
I guess we opened that 3 years ago, three
okay.
and a half years ago.
Great. And where? Yeah. So after you launched Cure, and especially with all the blood, sweat, and tears you put into opening it, and given its success, and then the growth in Pittsburgh, right? All of a sudden there are more restaurants and people are sort of saying, hey, you got to go to Pittsburgh. You got to check it out. You have to see what's going on there. Were people coming to you with opportunities? Is that how your second location came to be?
People were coming to me with opportunities, but I've really not played into that too much.
Okay.
I was always so dedicated to Cure that I didn't really even entertain any other opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
There was a point in time where I would tell myself that this is the only thing I'm ever going to do. I love Cure so much that I'm just going to come here every day.
Right. But yet you open a second restaurant.
Yeah, Morcia. My wife and I spent 3 weeks in Spain. Before we went to Spain, we had talked about how, you know, Cure was 4 years old, mm-hmm. and how we felt like it was in this really great place, and I was finally able to step away from being in the kitchen, you know, 15 hours a day, and what our opportunity was and what should we do. And we went to Spain, and I've always loved Spanish food. I'd never been to Spain until then. I'd worked for some guys that were Spanish. I'd worked for some guys that worked in Spain. Manresa was a very Spanish-influenced restaurant. Mm-hmm. And I just honestly, it just clicked in my brain as the minute we got there, because I think it's really hard to find a traditional tapas restaurant in America. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think we all know which ones there are, but like, there's nothing like that in Pittsburgh. And mm-hmm. it just, you know, I also wanted to do something that wasn't Cure, not because I didn't love it, but I knew if I was going to do something, I couldn't do another Cure that required 100% of me.
No, but this sounds like an interesting challenge. It sounds like, you know, a new cuisine, definitely within your realm of what you do, but obviously there's nothing like that at the time in Pittsburgh, so you're able to still keep your heart at Cure, but execute something completely new and keep your, you know, you got to keep yourself, you got to try new things in order to keep your creative juices flowing.
Absolutely. It was also a really great way for us to expand our charcuterie program. So we, previous to opening Murcia, we made all of our charcuterie at Cure with almost no technology. And sometimes I look back at how we did it and I question how we did it.
I bet.
So when we built Murcia, we put it's a 20 by 9 foot wide, pretty high-tech charcuterie room in the basement, and we upgraded all of our equipment. So that really allowed us to expand our charcuterie program. A, we got to focus on things that were specifically Spanish, and then once we started doing that, we started kind of elaborating and taking shots at our versions or our creative versions of things that are Spanish. And that continues to be a lot of fun. I actually really love a lot of what we do with charcuterie at Murcia, as much or more than what we do at Cure.
Well, can we back up for a minute? Because one of the things I don't think we've really discussed, and I mean, this does lead into the salty pork bits, your latest endeavor. But when we talk about charcuterie, it's just sort of this big blanket. Why don't we give, for those who are really unaware, that it's not just a little bit of prosciutto. I mean, there's so many different kinds of offerings in charcuterie. So can we educate people just a little bit on that?
I mean, realistically, if someone asks me that question, I think the real answer to what is charcuterie, it is basically the broadest definition is the preservation of food. So it can be fruit and it can be vegetables, it can be meat. But I think that realistically it is specific to whole animal butchery. I mean, my version of it is whole hog charcuterie. Mm-hmm. I mean, so, but basically any piece of food that you can preserve for the future is charcuterie, right?
Right. But what you were doing at Cure differed to the offerings you were doing at Murcia. And what did that mean? Like, what did the presentations look like? How did they differ?
Well, A, we were able to receive and deal with whole animals on a more realistic level.
Right, because Cure is small, the restaurant, size of it.
Cure doesn't have a walk-in cooler. So
sure.
We operate Cure with two-door coolers and a one-door freezer. Which works out great until you get the whole pig in and want to cure it.
Did you? Well, when you got a whole pig in and Cure, what did you do? Cut it down in the dining room? Because small. I remember.
Yeah,
right?
I would have to butcher it. I butcher it in the kitchen immediately.
Okay.
We just kind of had a plan around the delivery. Mm. But at Murcia, we have a walk-in cooler in our garage that is specific to receiving whole animals. So that says a world about the charcuterie that you can make, right? So
right.
All of a sudden, I have time to plan out what I'm going to do with maybe not just one whole animal, but maybe three or four whole animals, you know? So we've been able to, and not only that, like we're not worried about refrigeration space, right? So when you talk about things like curing, you know, and let's just use something as an example, like you had mentioned prosciutto, mm-hmm. That needs to be like cured in a refrigerator, right? So that word cure basically is we need to make that shelf stable. So because the room that we hang it in is outside of refrigeration temperature, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you know, prosciutto will spend 45 days on salt in a refrigerator before we hang it in our charcuterie room, which we operate at around 55 degrees.
Okay.
So that was the biggest benefit. We were able to have a refrigerator dedicated to just animals and curing their parts. And that we got to be more deliberate and put a plan together as to how we were going to use things in a way that we could never do it before. Because when we were just doing it at Cure, it was like, how do we get this thing in and out of the refrigerator as fast as possible?
Right.
And I think we did a really good job considering our resources, but it is amazing what happens when you have just a little bit more space.
Oh, I bet. And so were people just clamoring for your product, hence the decision to start selling it?
Yeah, I'm honestly, my expectations are continually blown.
Mm-hmm.
So we launched Salty Pork Bits in July of this year.
Right.
I guess my wife did, she launched, put the website together and launched it, I think, 3 days before she gave birth to our daughter.
Oh my God, she's a Viking.
She really is. I don't mess with her. but, you know, we started Salty Pork Bits as a online salami-specific, like, subscription program. And then since then, we've offered some, like, holiday-themed boxes.
So what are the kind of products that you're offering specifically? Like, is it multiple kinds of salamis?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, so our salami subscription up until now has been you buy 3 months, and every month you get four salamis in the mail, and every month you get four different salamis. So I think we have about 45 or 50 flavors of salami in the rotation right now, and we are experimenting. We have a list of, I think it's 13 or 14 flavors that we are testing out now for the future.
And can we get an example of some of these flavors?
Yeah, I just started buying beef from a friend of mine who owns a company here in Pittsburgh called Wild Purveyors, and it's Wagyu beef that's grown in Ohio, and it's really beautiful. So one of the things that, you know, we buy whole pigs that are really fatty, so part of utilizing all of that fat is buying in some beef that's leaner than pork, and we make like a beef and pork salami. So we're doing a beef au poivre salami, which is all the traditional flavors that would go into like a steak au poivre, you know, brandy and green peppercorns and Dijon. And then that salami is dusted in black pepper. And then we're doing another beef salami, which is a béarnaise salami that is studded with chunks of cured egg yolks instead of pork fat.
Yum, that sounds delicious.
And then we're making a béarnaise salami that is, we do like a béarnaise reduction, which is like caramelized shallots and red wine and port and river jus that we reduce down to a nice sticky glaze.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're studying that with chunks of bone marrow. And then another salami that I'm actually really excited about, I think I'm going to call it the Mike Solomonov.
Okay.
He's always trying to push me to make a salami for him.
Sure.
So we're going to do a lamb salami that's seasoned with tahini and mint and lemon and urfa and garlic, and then we're going to roll it in za'atar.
Oh, that sounds fabulous and good. Yeah. You should definitely make one for him as well. So you're making these salamis, but you decide to sell them, but now that you're making salamis for sale, did you have to get special legalities? Did you have to get things approved? How did you jump the shark on that one? How did you
make that happen? So that's the beauty of it. It's the same as it was before. So we are inspected by the Allegheny County Health Department, and we have a HACCP plan registered with them. And as I can basically ship to the end consumer in any state in America.
Wow.
So until I start selling to someone else who's going to resell it, I can continue to operate the way that I am now.
So that's why you went online. So because I don't think we've made that clear, right? So you can buy your products online with this subscription service. Can you also buy a la carte, or is it strictly subscription?
It's only subscription now, but the a la carte option is coming in the near future.
Okay, and so we've been talking so much about how much you love Cure, and now you're closing it.
Yeah.
Why? Well, why are you closing it?
Well, that's the thing about Cure, and I think a lot of people have a hard time understanding that. But you, very selfishly, I mean, Cure has always been about what I want, And I think that's what's made Cure successful. And, you know, that I started the process of opening Cure over 8 years ago. You know, I was in, like, 32 years old.
A baby. You were just a baby.
I was a, realistically. And, you know, I love Cure. Cure is probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my entire life. I would say it's probably personally and professionally one of the best accomplishment, the greatest accomplishments of my life. I couldn't be more proud of the work that not just I have done there, but the people and the team. And, you know, honestly, I've never realized how amazing a team of people could be until I owned Cure. But I'm just going to go back to, like, Cure's always been about me, and I just want to do something new. And I think this is the luxury of, I guess, getting Cure to the point that it is. You know, I can afford to do what I want to do with it, and I just would hate for it to ever be anything other than that. I don't want to ever, like, I hate the idea of being stuck doing something for reasons that aren't mine. And, you know, realistically, a huge reason why I opened Cure, it was because of all this work I've been putting into my charcuterie. And now, like, this overwhelming response to salty pork bits, really made, and not to mention having, we had Hillary and I had a daughter 7 months ago, which has really opened my eyes to what are you doing
right
every day of your life for the rest of your life?
Absolutely. You know? Children will change you. It's true.
Yeah. So, you know, the response to salty pork bits was immediately amazing, right? Mm-hmm. I want to say the first subscription sold out with less than 24 hours, and we have increased the volume every subscription, and it continues to sell out. The one that we just announced the other day is still available because we doubled it. We doubled our subscription from the last.
So what does that mean for people who are interested in this?
Go to saltyporkbits.com and sign up.
Okay, just sign up. And then what do you get it, every 3 months?
You get one box per month for 3 months.
One box per month for 3 months. Okay.
Yeah, four salamis per month.
Mm-hmm. And it's always based on whatever it is you guys are creating at the time. And it sounds like you're a little bit like a mad scientist, playing with lots of flavors and tastes to create what you want.
It's a really fun thing to do. I mean, we also stick to a lot of the traditional flavors. I mean, you know, we do the Toscano and the Finocchiona and Andouille and all those things and Spanish chorizo. But it's a really fun way to express yourself with food, you know, because I think people are so used to salamis tasting and looking the same way. And I think when someone puts a salami that tastes like a Negroni in their mouth and they're like, holy shit, this actually tastes like a Negroni.
Right.
You know, I mean, that's really fun for me.
Well, I think it's fun for the diner as well. Plus, you know, there's some sort of cachet these days, you know, at dinner parties and things like that to bring something really exciting and different to the table. And your salamis certainly fit the bill. You know, it's, I think it's, as we talked about, convenience earlier. It's easy to stop somewhere and get it all sliced up and already done, but it's another thing to, you know, order it, bring it in, and be like, look what I got. And here, you know, look at these different flavors and do something completely different.
Absolutely.
But now, you still have Marsella. Am I saying it right? I look at the way it's spelled, and I know it's pronounced differently, and it totally, like, gives me a panic attack.
it's Marsella. You almost had it.
Okay, Marsella. So that is going to stay open, correct?
Yeah, absolutely.
But now you do have another property coming up on the horizon, right?
Yep.
So you want to tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, we are partnering with a good old friend of mine. His name is Scott Smith, and he owns East End Brewery, which is, Pittsburgh is experiencing this crazy craft beer boom, as it is a lot of cities. I think we went from having, like, God, like three breweries to having almost 40 now.
Wow.
And Scott has been there since the beginning. I want to say that with the exception of 10 Brewery, East End Brewery, I think, is the most OG craft brewery in the city of Pittsburgh. Scott was one of the first friends I made when I moved back to Pittsburgh, because even before I moved back from California, I was, like, online trying to find, like, basically lettuce and beer. And so I think I was back in Pittsburgh for like 3 days, and I was like, I need to meet the guy that owns this place. So we've become friends really quickly. He's been a part of everything that we've done, and so, yeah, we are building out a restaurant inside of his tasting room in the East End, and it should be open sometime in April or May.
That's incredible. So that's very exciting. And what can people, is it just, will it be just buying things? Is it will you still be a restaurant? What is it?
It's going to be a very casual restaurant. You're going to counter service. You're going to take a
like
flag
sandwiches?
With a number on it away. Yeah, and this is going to be a way for us to expand our product line for salty pork bits. So we are going to start making fresh sausages, and that's something that I love making. And I think I think in general a lot of people like eating sausage. But going back to what we were talking about,
a personal standpoint, I probably eat sausages 3 or 4 times a week. I'm a huge protein person, so I
they're a nice thing to eat.
They're delicious and they're healthy. If I'm sticking to a protein heavy way of living, I really enjoy them and I love them. So I'm with you on that. Get started.
And I mean, just like going back to the conversation about butcher shops, Pittsburgh is a city that is like built on butcher shops, and we don't really have them anymore. There used to be a butcher shop in Lawrenceville. That just closed, and I've got people that like I've never met before that call Cure because they know we make charcuterie, and they say things like, "Can you make us kielbasa?" Because there's nowhere to buy it.
Isn't that amazing?
Nowadays, like if someone wants sausage, you have to go to Whole Foods to get it. And so I'm really excited about that. I'm also really just excited about making charcuterie that is more everyday charcuterie stuff that you want to keep in your refrigerator, right? Like ham for sandwiches and pastrami and corned beef and bologna. And we're going to start making some salamis like in like Koto style salamis, which are more like a sandwich salami. I'm really excited about that because I own bacon.
Oh, wow.
At some point we'll have that for
great.
Sale. Yeah.
So that's all going to be at the larder, right?
Yep.
The larder at Larimer, and that's going to be opening late April, early May-ish?
Hypothetically.
Hopefully,
speaking, yes.
Hopefully. Yeah, no, we can't put any. If Pittsburgh's anything like D.C., I mean, it takes time. It just takes time. That's the way it goes. Well, listen, I really want to thank you for joining us today. You're doing so many amazing things in Pittsburgh. I wish you would come on down to D.C. But just lastly, so now that you are closing Cure, what are you doing with it?
So I'm going to turn it into basically the thing that kickstarted my career. The space that kickstarted my career which is Cure, is going to be the space that kickstarts our salty pork bits. So we are going to turn it into a very simple charcuterie production space. You're still going to be able to come in and eat food there, and there's a really great chance that you'll be able to come in and have Cure-style dinners.
Oh, so you'll use the space a little bit, like pop-up, something like that?
Yeah, I think we'll do it on a regular basis.
Oh,
yeah.
Great. All right, well, we'll stay tuned on that. Were you going to say one more thing?
Oh, we're going to also add, for the people that live in Pittsburgh, a place for local deliveries or local pickups. Because,
like a CSA?
Well, up until now, or even our salty pork bits subscriptions, we've shipped in Pittsburgh just because the logistics of getting people into a busy restaurant, to pick up their package seems like a nightmare. So now we'll have that place for people to come and pick up.
Oh, that's fantastic. Well, Justin, I really appreciate your time today, and I'm so excited about everything you're doing. Just tell people where they can go online and find your product and get a membership or a subscription.
SaltyPorkBits.com.
Sorry, say it again.
SaltyPorkBits.com.
It sounds delicious just when you say it. Well, thank you again for joining us.
You.
And I want to thank everybody for joining us today. Industry Night at the Line Hotel. This is Nikki Nellis. Of course, you can find us on all forms if you're looking to download this for a podcast. But we're on Full Service Radio. Next week, we'll have the woman behind 305 Fitness. She has been teaching all the people around D.C., actually in Boston and New York, and she's opening up in Miami and L.A. These are hip-hop dance classes, and they are a 600 to 800 calorie workout that is so much fun with a DJ in the workout studio. We're going to find all about what Sadie Kurzan has come up with her 305 Fitness. Again, I want to thank you all for joining us today. Justin, thank you for joining us. And everybody, please have a delicious week.
Thanks for listening to this program on Full Service Radio, broadcasting and recording from the Line Hotel in Adams Morgan, Washington, D.C. Full Service Radio programming can be accessed live and archived on fullserviceradio.org. Our talk programming is available on most podcast apps like iTunes and Stitcher, and our DJ sets are available on mixcloud.com/fullserviceradio. Full Service Radio features over 30 weekly shows and over 50 local hosts covering every topic imaginable. If you want to be a guest or get involved, email us at info@fullserviceradio.org. Follow us on Twitter @FullServiceRDO, on Instagram and Facebook @FullServiceRadio. Thanks for listening.